Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 12 of Connecting with Can, a podcast dedicated to sharing Coordinate Network's experiences on working with migrant workers. I'm your host, Sahaj Tracy, and on today's podcast, we have Jeff, Miriam, and Abby, and we'll be talking about challenges facing migrant workers in Kuwait, employment. Hi, everyone. It's so nice to hear from you guys again.
Hi, Sahaj.
Hello. So happy to be here.
So let's get right into it. So as we know, migrant workers continue to navigate a system that is inherently against them being able to make a decent living, as we've talked about in our previous podcast. So what further problems can arise from employment issues?
I think, like we talked about in the last episode, when we talked about documentation for migrant workers, episode 10, the issue of documentation or knowing what documents you have also transfers into what employment looks like. Most migrant workers do not actually know anything about their residencies, whether it's how to get a residency, what paperwork you need for that residency, how you renew your residency after it's, you know, finished its 1, 2, or 3 year time period. How to cancel a residency if you want to resign from your job and go back to your home country, or you want to transfer your residency to a different job, or change the type of residency you have to have a different type of job. These things are generally difficult to access, and I think as we've kind of seen as a running theme throughout these episodes, is that knowing Arabic is primary, and then knowing some English is also important, but really knowing Arabic is the only way to truly understand reading and writing the labor laws, or to access government institutions and agencies to actually find out what you need to do, how it's done, and what are the rules and frameworks around them. This is getting a little bit better recently, but it's still very difficult to understand what to do without using an Arab-speaking intermediary or Kuwaiti citizen to do the work. And this is the main issue. So, I mean, one of the first issues, of course, is people don't know the employment jobs or employment laws. So when you actually get your residency, oftentimes for a large amount of domestic workers, they actually don't understand how they got the residency in the first place, what was taken into account when they got the residency, how their salary is calculated, what their position is. On your civil ID that every citizen and resident has in Kuwait, it actually says your job position if you're working at a specific type of agency. Especially for migrant workers in the private sector and public sector. And this is actually determines the level of your salary, which is written and inscribed in your residency permit. Most migrant workers actually do not know what their salary is, or the salary that they're given on their salary certificate, like the official one, is not the same as the salary they're actually paid. They may be paid less on the official one and more for their actual salary, or vice versa, or the same. But having a salary and a certain level of salary actually is highly important to how they can live their lives. For example, having a base salary of under 250 makes it very difficult to get a bank account. If you have a salary under 250, you're not eligible for certain types of government services. If you're a domestic worker working in a home as a driver, you are not allowed to get a bank account without your sponsor's consent and their name on the bank account. There's all these limitations to the type of residency you have. There's various types of residencies in Kuwait, the main ones being an Article 17 visa, which is a government migrant worker working in the government sector, an Article 18 visa, which is a migrant worker working in the private sector, and then there's an Article 20 visa, which is the article for domestic workers, which can either be men or females, domestic maids, drivers, or cleaners within people's homes. Many people do not actually know this distinction when they come to Kuwait of what this actually means for them legally. They're here to work. It's a good place to make money to send home. So people are not at the initial stage of them coming to the country, usually very well aware of what it looks like to actually get a residency and keep it in Kuwait. This uncertainty and the lack of information makes it very easy for people to be manipulated or to be cheated. And oftentimes this is actually done by people who live here for a long period of time, not citizens alone, but people who live here a long time, often from their own nationalities, who take money on the side or make an extra buck off of the newcomer. This is quite common here. If you go online and look in a variety of languages that are widely spoken in Kuwait, you will see all kinds of rumors and fake news about a variety of labor laws or how to fix your residency or how to renew a residency or how to file a case in court for a labor law. There's a lot of inaccurate information out there, which within communities is quite widely spread, and, you know, people take advantage. There's lots of con artists. I mean, the lack of information is the most basic issue. The second issue that I think is equally as important is knowing where to go to file a labor case or to actually find out what kind of information you can get. There's a variety of government institutions in Kuwait that provide this type of information, whether it's the Ministry of Justice buildings in the downtown of the country or at the courthouses, the main courthouse complex in Farwaniya would be another place where you could access this information, or the Ministry of Social Affairs and Labor building in Ahmadi Governorate in the town of Ahmadi. There is places to access this information for a worker going on their own. That being said, these places are far away from each other. They're also expensive to take cabs on. There's not good, reliable public transportation to these areas. And often the people who actually need to access these services are people who actually don't have money because of the situation they're in. So it's a vicious cycle where they actually can't afford to take the cab or to the area where they need to go to find the information out to actually protect themselves. And often what happens is that these people are doing it after everything's gone wrong, after the residency is canceled for a certain period of time, after they've lost their job, after they've run out of money, and it's a desperate move. And often by this point, they're already tired and disheartened, which leaves them in a very precarious situation, which often leads to them just remaining illegal in the country or deported if they so choose. Often people turn themselves in to be deported to leave. How migrant workers navigate this varies. Often it's by simply just going along with the flow and hoping things turn out. Unfortunately, Kuwait labor law is quite strict about how to file cases, how long you should take to file a case, 3 months within the residency expiring, how to go to court and file a case. You need a Kuwaiti lawyer, which is expensive. To open a file in the court, it costs 100 KD, Kuwaiti dinar per case. So all these things make it difficult for a non-Arabic speaker who's from a lower income to actually access the legal resources you need. If you have money and you have access to these resources, it is quite easy to protect yourself in the law. But of course, having money and having a steady income and the ability to actually access these resources is privilege. And the vast majority of people do not have these privileges. So this forces them into illegal work, which is quite common.
We understand there's like some difficulties in dealing with sponsors, as is the case in many countries that use the kafala system, such as them having total control of all aspects of your employment, of, you know, pay, working conditions, and hours. Can you just speak a bit more to that?
Absolutely. I mean, great questions. I mean, sponsors, there's a variety of different types of sponsors. I mean, we've talked a little bit about this in other podcasts, but, you know, you could literally be in someone's home looking after their kids or cleaning their house or driving their kids to school or, you know, in this type of situation, which is a highly personalized situation where you become part of a family. So in this situation, the abuse can be abuse and difficulties can be quite problematic because being in the family, you might know about their financial situation not being too good, or them having mental health crises or other issues that they might be coming into, or like personal crises. And as an employee living within their home, you're more likely to sympathize with the family over your own pay or rights. And often what happens in situations is people find themselves not being paid and not being treated as well as they should because they're part of the family and they're considered part of the family at the same time as they're an employee for the family that's under their control. And this is a very challenging part of being a domestic worker. And so for someone who lives in someone's home, there's a lot of personalized relationships that make it difficult when their labor rights are not being impacted, especially when it comes to pay or long hours. I mean, some of the most common stories you hear is people working 16-hour days, looking after multiple children, making multiple meals for different family members who come and go from the house at different times. So they might make three different breakfasts and three different lunches and, you know, have specific dietary requirements on top of cleaning a very large, spacious house. So, I mean, these are some of the issues. And because they're, quote unquote, family, this makes it more difficult for them to actually get themselves out of the situation when their labor rights are not being followed. And often it ends with them simply leaving the house of their own volition because they can't handle the situation physically and mentally, like over time. And often this happens over years. It's not a short-term thing, it's over years. Other sponsors, you know, small companies where it's also highly personalized, where it's like the partners or like close employers. This is also a difficult situation, often in newer companies where, you know, it's established, you know, you're building. So there's difficulties with the company moving forward and making revenue. And often employees in these types of newer companies or smaller companies struggle with telling their boss that they deserve their labor rights or proper pay, even if the owner of the company can't actually afford it. That's not their problem as employees. I have a right to be paid regardless of the company's like financial challenges. And often, because it's also highly personalized, this makes it very difficult for workers who end up working far longer than they should. And often what happens is these types of companies, eventually the owner cannot afford anything. And the workers end up having to pay for their own residency fees and their own fines for residencies being delayed and these types of things, own accommodations. And this is actually a very common story. And then, of course, there's larger companies where you're working for like a large construction company or engineering firm or cleaning company or school or something like this, where you're just a number. You're not a name. There's thousands of people working for this company where it's much more bureaucratic and much more organized, but there may be more difficult technical reasons why you won't be able to withdraw from your job or change jobs, because the company may have internal rules that are not legal within the country's labor law, but they enforce them anyways because they're a large company, a large corporate backing. It's much more difficult to actually go against them. And this is typically an issue of transferring residencies from a specific large company to another, where they basically will be like, we will not transfer your residency. We will not actually allow you to leave. And if you do leave, we'll make you pay a penalty for leaving, which is illegal. And we will hold your passport and you will be deported. This happens often as a negotiation tactic. Often workers are trapped in their jobs or told to wait another year until, you know, they find more labor for them to leave. And this is a common strategy of corporate sponsors to keeping the labor they have so they don't have to recycle labor in the country or get someone from outside. It's very capitalistic and it's very transactional, these relationships. And I mean, this is, I think, would be the thing that I would say more than anything is, often these types of relationships between migrants and sponsors are looked at as personalized other than the corporate one. But the personalized relationships, the power is all in the sponsor's hand. And the personal relationship is used as a way of making the migrant feel comfortable at the same time as they're being exploited. And it's very transactional. The assumption is you work for me because we're family and you need me, but I will not pay you. I will not follow the labor law. And if things go wrong, you are going to be hurt and I'm going to walk away. And that's the common theme that you see throughout this, the sponsorship system.
Well, thank you so much for being here, guys. And thank you all for listening to this episode of Connecting with Can. We hope you're having a wonderful day and we'll see you next week. Stay connected.